Yanukovych is addressing the few press members who assembled here this afternoon.
To come over. What I'm going to provide you with are some questions and answers that we've been getting throughout the day, some by some and by others. Okay, is the spill going into the Gulf of Alaska? No, it's located in an area. If you draw a line from Knoll's Head to Naked Island and go north to the spill site, that's where the spill is located. The current spill size is approximately 100 square miles. The amount recovered, that will be available after 1800 this evening. Exxon will be gauging the recovery tanks at that time. The amount that is leaked, the Coast Guard has revised its estimates from over 250,000 barrels to about 240,000 barrels. I believe these coincide with Exxon's. For those of you interested, the National Transportation Safety Board arrived at approximately 11 o'clock today. They changed clothes and were flown out to the Exxon Valdez about an hour later. They've indicated that they will be on the Exxon Valdez for 6 or 7 hours, 5 to 6 hours in that time frame. And they're not prepared to comment on their activities yet, otherwise we'd have them up here. I'm sorry, there are four people from the National Transportation Safety Board, and unfortunately I don't have their names. They didn't stop long enough. Has the leaking stopped? Yes, the leaking has stopped. The amount of fuel oil transferred from the Exxon Valdez to the Baton Rouge. As of noontime today, 37,583 barrels using pumps from the Coast Guard strike team has been transferred to the Exxon Baton Rouge. Coast Guard activities involve helicopters from Air Station Kodiak, ferrying materials from the Valdez Airport out to the tanker, also personnel. Is the spill contained? No. No, the southern edge, as I said, is on roughly on a line from Knoll's Head to Naked Island. The only impact so far has been on Reef Island and Bligh Island. I do not have the penalty for pilotage requirements, or if somebody violates pilotage requirements. That seemed to be popular this afternoon. Okay, a pilot is required from Rocky Point, or let's say from the Port of Valdez out to Rocky Point. From Rocky Point to approximately the Bligh Reef area, a person with a pilot endorsement, doesn't have to be the master, but a person with a pilot endorsement on his license must be on the bridge of the vessel. Okay, from the Port of Valdez, from Port Valdez to Rocky Point, a pilot must be on the vessel. From Rocky Point to an area roughly level with Bligh Island, or alongside Bligh Island, a person with a pilot endorsement must be on the bridge of the vessel.
Is there any way in general to report that?
I'm not sure, sir. I don't know. I know we don't have Coast Guard personnel riding the tankers in and out. It's a requirement. I also understand the state of Alaska has its own set of pilotage requirements. That's why we are not able to determine the penalties for not having a pilot on board.
Did the person make that at the endorsement?
As far as I know, sir, no, he didn't. I believe Exxon said that later on, earlier this afternoon. The results of the first dispersion test, they worked, but they weren't as efficient as they'd like, as hoped. For the burning test did show lots of promise. They were going to be trying it on a larger scale later this afternoon, so I imagine we're talking about right about now. And finally, we did receive some questions. No, sir, I don't, but if you'll get with me afterwards, I'll try and get that information to you, and if you could spread it around, I'm sure there's a lot of interest. Okay, we've been asked several times to comment on the initial response of Alyeska and Exxon. Okay, we're not going to talk about it anymore. It's been addressed several times by Alyeska and Exxon. They've made their own admissions as to what they did right and what they did wrong, so it's starting to get redundant. However, on the present activities, I have the following quote from Commander Steve McCall. He's the captain of the port and the federal on-scene coordinator. And I quote, "They brought in a lot of equipment and more is coming in. Getting it from the arrival points in Valdez to the scene has been, is, and will continue to be one of the more difficult parts of the operation. Exxon's doing well under an extremely difficult, extremely difficult response situation, the extent of which has never been seen in the history of pollution response in the United States. That's a direct quote from Commander McCall. I just left him. And finally, for those of you that may be interested, Commander McCall's staff is working on a way to reopen the port of Valdez.
How long do you think that might be still take to come and reload?
I'm not sure, sir. The executive officer is involved in it, and he just got back off the Exxon Valdez. It may be 1 or 2 days, it may be 3 days, but right in that time frame.
The pipeline isn't, those ships aren't loaded over, say, a week. What's the concern?
I'm not sure, sir. I do know Exxon has mentioned that they have a 6-day storage capacity in there. So, yes, Mr. Campbell.
I think how long you were, I think they both need kind of condition test.
The in-place burning test, from what I understand, sir, a certain amount of oil, or an amount of oil is corralled. Then some type of incendiary, I believe it's a jellied gasoline mixture, something highly flammable is put inside to aid in the combustion, and from there it will burn. They try and corral it in. I believe they use a fireproof boom, and then they try and burn the oil that's on in the corralled by the boom.
The earlier one that they tried, they were satisfied with?
Yeah, they were very happy with the results. They're going to try it on a larger scale.
Does that actually burn the oil up then?
Yeah, we're talking. Yes, sir, it does burn and smoke and flames. Not as effective as they had hoped. No, sir, I don't. Yes, ma'am.
Can you talk about the, if you want to talk about it anymore, but the blood alcohol test. When that was administered to the crew?
I can tell you it was administered Friday morning, ma'am, or the blood samples were taken Friday morning. I'm not sure of the exact time.
Would that be, like, after 8 a.m.?
No, because I didn't get here until I started getting my orders, and it had been done before I got here.
So do you have the results
in? No, sir, I don't.
When did you do it?
I don't know, sir.
Are you gonna make them public once you get them back?
As I said before, the test results will become part of the investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board will have those results. It appears right now that they will be conducting a separate investigation besides the Coast Guard's. When the results of the investigation come out, that's when I anticipate the results will be released to the public.
In your investigation,
the three principals involved admitted taking alcohol or using drugs during the course of this, aside from the test?
No, sir, I'm not aware of anything to that, and I don't think that the tests admit that, sir. It's two separate issues.
What's our best estimate or best reason as to why this ship did go so far off course? Do you have at this time a theory that you...
No, sir, we don't. The Coast Guard provides the aids to navigations, and we provide services in the area. We don't know why the vessel went aground.
Your radar system extends far enough out past that hazardous area.
I'm sorry, sir?
Why does your radar system, which tracks these vessels, why does it not extend out far enough past that hazardous area?
Well, sir, the area where the vessel went aground is at the edge, at the perimeter of the radar system, and I think, depending on the circumstances and the scales, it may extend even farther. It's important to note that the vessel wasn't being monitored, and it's in an area where vessels normally aren't monitored. There was no other traffic. The visibility was good. The master requested permission to go from the outbound lane to the inbound lane to avoid ice. And I believe the tanker in front of them may have requested the same permission. I'm not sure about that. But it's not an unusual request. No, there was nothing unusual. Yes, ma'am.
This pilot endorsement on the license, is that the same as the certification? Is it a sticker on his license? What is it?
Whether he has a little stamp? I'm not sure exactly what it entails, but certain requirements have to be met for him to get an endorsement, something that says he is qualified to pilot vessels, act as a pilot for vessels in that area.
In that area. And that's
for example, a pilot certificate for Rocky Point wouldn't necessarily be valid for Louisiana.
Okay, and this is because the area is narrow, because there are
certain requirements when you navigate in every area. I believe this, the requirements also carry all the way down to, say, what we call a six-pack license. You know, they're only valid in certain areas because certain local knowledge is required.
I'm curious as to why your radar operator authorized a change in course, and having done so, didn't continue to track him.
I don't know, sir. But I do know that the change, the request, was not unusual, and it's an area that's not normally tracked if there's no other traffic in the area.
What was, in fact, there ice in the sound at that point?
There's ice in the sound now, sir.
I understand.
Any other questions, please?
Yes. Is there a penalty associated with, that you know of, with navigating or piloting a ship in that area without the proper endorsements?
I imagine there is, sir. I don't know. Before I came over here, we were attempting to, or I had asked some of the marine safety people what the penalty was, because I anticipated that question. Unfortunately, it's an area, I believe, that the state also has certain requirements, so there are two sets of penalties, and they may be mixed or whatever.
They don't have a certification process, or they...
I don't know. Okay, Exxon has assumed responsibility for the spill. I know you've heard that before. That means they're in charge of coordinating resources to take care of cleaning up the spill, of coordinating the skimmers, of unloading fuel from the Exxon Valdez to the Exxon Baton Rouge. At this point in time, the on-scene coordinator, in coordination with the regional response team, provides assistance to Exxon. They do this in the form of what resources we have available. They provide technical expertise along the lines of, there's a scientific coordinator there for issues that relate to environmental impact. So right now, we're sitting back and we're monitoring Exxon's activities. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry, the on-scene coordinator is Commander Steve McCall. He is also captain of the port for Port Valdez. Oh, sure. And these notes, we'll smooth type them out and get you plenty of copies. Okay. He asked me to repeat it if you don't mind. Okay. Okay, again, this is a quote from Commander Steve McCall, captain of the port and the federal on-scene coordinator. They brought in lots of equipment and more is coming in. Getting from the arrival points in Valdez to the scene has been, is, and will continue to be one of the more difficult parts of the operation. Exxon's doing well under extremely, extremely difficult response situation, the extent of which has never been seen in the history of the pollution response in the United States. Now, sir.
Do you anticipate any difficulty because of this wind, and if there's a storm that is in fact brewing, what do you think this might do to the spill at this point?
Well, I know that the wind will help with the dispersant use, but I also realize I'm not sure what impact it will have on the stability of the vessel. Wind is something that every mariner takes into consideration. Excuse me. Yes, sir.
Up until about 1982, vessel traffic controllers were required to pause the vessel once the pilot departed Rocky Point once every 6 minutes until clear of dry reef. When they would take that bearing and range from Potato Point, they were required at that time to plot the position of the vessel on a chart,
copy chart. In about 1982, the Coast Guard stopped requiring their vessel traffic controllers to physically plot that on a chart, where they would just ink plot it on the map, and they would record those bearing and ranges every 6 minutes, and those would go into a permanent file. Why isn't the Coast Guard now physically plotting those ships as they go out through the narrows and keeping a consistent record of it? The reason for doing that was so the controller would watch the ship.
I don't know, sir. That decision was made in 1982. I can't really comment on it now. Go ahead.
These vessels request to avoid icebergs at this time of year?
No, sir.
What percentage of them are?
Why haven't
you
found that out?
That seems like a real simple thing to find out.
Sir, I've been involved with the spill for the last few days. Nobody except, in fact, that's the first time that question's come up. I'll be glad to work with you after this briefing to see what we can do.
Is oil being pumped off now?
Yes, sir, it is. That estimate was as of noon. I haven't been able to get
there
that
data. It has been continual.
Yes, sir. And I believe earlier today I mentioned that they were pumping 10,000 gallons a barrel. I can't remember the number.
And this is with those portable pumps. pumps as opposed
right,
to the ship's pumping system?
Yes, ma'am.
Is it Coast Guard's responsibility to make sure that these oil cleanup contingency plans are up to snuff, or is that just something you rely on?
I don't know, sir. I believe you asked that question earlier, and I'll try and get that answer back.
No, a different question.
Okay, somebody else had asked that question earlier, and I haven't been able to find that answer up there at that time. Yes, sir.
Dryer Rock is up to 12 square miles.
You're saying 100?
Yes, sir.
How do you account for that discrepancy?
I don't know, sir. The captain of the port, Commander McCall, has estimated it to be approximately a square, about 10 miles by 10 miles. I can't account for this discrepancy. I do know that Commander McCall is meeting with Mr. Iarossi now to talk over different aspects of the operation. I have time for one more if anybody's interested.
How much further would the vessel have needed to travel for the license endorsement not to have been necessary? How far short of the endorsement boundary was the vessel when it went
on the water? Okay, I'm not sure of the exact boundary. I know it's in the area of Bly Reef.
The helmsman, sir, the helmsman, the third mate, and the captain have all been tested, blood test?
Yes, sir.
And do you have the name of the helmsman? It wasn't given out today.
No, I don't have it.
And is it drug as well as alcohol?
It's a blood test. I'm not sure if it's an all-encompassing test or what.
Okay.
So
what is it now up to whatever wind speed was being forecast?
I don't know.
This is Dave Havoc. For those stations that may have just joined us, the Coast Guard has been giving a briefing. Coast Guard Lieutenant Veliskevich has been speaking, and now Tom McGinnis from the National Oceanic River from NOAA is now to the podium.
Yeah.
We are live at the Valley Civic Center.
I'm the Assistant Administrator for Ocean Services and Coastal Zone Management at NOAA, also Director of the National Ocean Service. We have a prepared statement that's sitting out by the door here, and I will summarize it quickly, and then I'll tell you why I came up. First thing I'd like you to mention is that under the National Contingency Plan, NOAA provides technical personnel to the Coast Guard and coordinates the science among the federal and state agencies. We have 20 people on site right now. They are gathered from all over the United States, as are you, and they represent our Western Regional Hazardous Spill Laboratory in Seattle, the National Marine Mammal Lab, the Office of Aircraft Operations in Miami, the Auk Bay Lab of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and of course the Weather Service office here in Valdez. Some of the personnel that are here today have been involved in every major oil spill in the United States for the last 13 years. So they bring a tremendous historical knowledge of how these things develop. Our concerns are as serious as they are urgent. This is a unique situation in that it is a very remote area presenting very difficult problems, and we see a potential for acute and severe impacts to the animals that use the surface of the waters, i.e. marine mammals, seabirds, and intertidal fisheries. We're also concerned about the long-term impacts of salmon fry, herring, spawn, and tanner crab. Every afternoon and evening, our experts are making oil distribution maps and projections of the oil spill trajectory, also doing weather forecasts, detailed marine mammal surveys, and during the day sampling the intertidal shellfish and sediments and investigating the extent of the oil, both the two-dimensional extent of the oil on the surface and the amount of oil in the water column under the slick in the waters of Prince William Sound. One of the problems we've had over the last couple of days has been that given the color of the water and the lighting, it's been very, very difficult to see the extent of the oil from the air and to evaluate it, its thickness and extent. We've been making daily flights in the NOAA helicopter to assess the situation and gather data. And then using our models over at the Westmark Hotel, we've been doing these trajectories and forecasts. Since I arrived yesterday, I've met with the Coast Guard and with the representatives of Exxon. And today I visited the site with the Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District. And then all afternoon I spent with the NOAA team flying over the slick. I wanted to be available to you today because it's been our sense that you could use a little more hard information about the impact and the extent of the slick itself. So I brought along with me a number of folks who are expert in oil spill dynamics, historical extent of oil spill impacts, the effects on the water column, the coastal zone, fisheries, marine mammals, the birds. I don't know if the National Weather Service guy is here to give you a forecast, but I have tried to get him over here. And also, if you are interested in the interaction among the federal and state and Alaskan state officials, there's someone here to talk about that. I just felt that if you have any of those questions, I've tried to make the people who could give you specific and detailed answers about that available. The other thing is, I apologize, I had hoped to come in with an oil spill evaluation to show you the extent specifically of the spill in Prince William Sound. Unfortunately, we didn't land until nearly quarter after three, so it's not ready, but it will be available over at the Westmark within the hour. In the chart room, which is the name of the room that we're using for our headquarters. And following following the creation of that map, which details the extent of the oil spill, we then will start working with the models to come up with forecasts of where it will be tomorrow and tomorrow night and the next day. Unfortunately, since the map itself won't be available till 6, and then we have to work from that, the forecast won't be available till quite late this evening, between 10 and midnight, but they will be there for you if you want them. So does anybody have any questions about some of the impacts of the oil? Go ahead, sorry?
Would you classify this as a catastrophe yet?
Yet? No. Well, I guess that's all on how you define it, isn't it, really? It's been quite a well-behaved spill up until now. One of the things we noticed as we flew over was that it has yet to, it's really only affected the shore in one area that we could see. That is the backside of Reef Island. But, of course, it's not dispersing. And the wind is picking up outside, so the potential is there.
As far as the impact on the water column, if dispersants are used, we've been given all sorts of different figures for how much of the spill they might be able to affect. But the chemical, I mean, basically, as I understand it, what that the dispersants do is break down the oil into smaller particles, and then that still descends into the water table. So is that the case? And if that is the case, what is the implication of that for the eventual impact of just using dispersants to treat the spill on bottom fish, shellfish, and other marine life?
Jackie, are you listening to this? Jackie Michelle, you want to come up here? We've just had quite a long conversation about that, and Jackie is an expert in that area, so I think the best thing to do is make her available.
Okay, my name is Jackie Michelle with NOAA, and I guess Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L.
The issues with use of dispersants are really a trade-off between what we consider to be intertidal impacts and subtidal impacts. So when you disperse the oil from the water surface, all you're trying to do is increase the rate of dilution. Oil on the water surface does not dilute very rapidly. It takes a long time, weeks, up to weeks perhaps. So by mixing it in the water column, you're diluting it to a much larger area, and that will hopefully reduce the exposures.
Now, as far as the hydrographics within Prince William Sound, there's been some discussion of water over a 10-day period flushing out to, I think it's Montague Strait or something like that. What does that mean as far as, whether or not the oil as it disperses would accumulate in significant amounts affecting, say, the pink salmon or the herring spawn or whatever? I mean, do you have any idea on that yet?
Jerry, you want to answer that? We have an oceanographer who can do that much better than I can.
KCHU Radio in Valdez. We are broadcasting at this moment a live press conference from the Valdez Civic Center ballroom. NOAA coordinator Tom McGinnis has brought in a variety of specialists who are working with the various agencies that are responding.
Your comment that the circulation in Prince William Sound basically comes in through Hinchinbrook and leaves through Montague. It is a circulation that comes and goes, so there's a natural sort of flushing process. If the oil were simply to stay exactly with the water, then it would exit, and that would be the end of it, and there probably wouldn't be large accumulations in virtually any measurable sense. Unfortunately, the oil really, in the form it's in, is floating on the surface, and it's affected by other things. In particular, there's a lot of mixing from fresh water coming off of the glacier. In particular, Glacier Bay, that area, people have been out flying around. You can see that different coloration to that water and the mixing front that's going on. In addition to that, the wind pushes the oil that's floating around on top of the water, and so although the water may turn and go out in 10 days, if it gets pushed into a little bay, that doesn't flush in 10 days. So to the extent that you have shoreline impacts, you wouldn't expect those to flush quickly. And so it's a little bit more complicated than the water just going in and out, which it certainly does.
So, we should maybe get back to you on that point then. What does that tell us? The fishermen have made time and again clear that what they're most concerned about is the potential impact on the herring roe fishery that's coming up and on the pink salmon. And the people that are with the hatcheries here have been talking about their concern over being able to release the flies so that they'll have zooplankton or phytoplankton or whatever it is that they eat. Do we know at this point anything about what the potential impact is going to be?
We actually know quite a bit about the toxicity of this oil. And the reason that you want to disperse it is because you're trying to dilute it down to levels that are not toxic. From a lot of studies done in this oil, the most toxic life forms are going to be the larval stages, the most young life history stages. We don't expect much toxicity on the adult fish. It's the larvae we're concerned about. So you want to dilute it down to levels below which it's toxic. And the data for this oil show that it has toxicity on the order of 1 to 2 parts per million. So we can get the oil diluted down to below those levels, we shouldn't expect any toxic effects. And that's the idea, is to get them diluted down. When you have a thin layer of oil, you're mixing that into a very large water column. Studies have shown that even if you disperse this oil, it would naturally mix in the water down to below 1 part per million in about 30 feet. So it's an upper water column toxic shock, but once that gets further diluted, it should be down below the levels that we consider to be toxic to these shellfish and finfish. Biodegradable, it will actually degrade, and so this is a lot different than any other kind of more persistent hydrocarbons. It will degrade down to very low levels and actually be removed over time. So we don't expect a food chain potential. That only occurs when we have persistent chemicals.
Are these dispersants, I heard that maybe it's more concentrated because of the water temperature here?
Well, they might be using higher dosage rates to try to increase the efficiency of the dispersant, but the dispersant they're using is either as toxic or less toxic than the oil. So it's not adding any toxicity.
No, constituents are the dispersant that they're using?
It's proprietary, and so that's not known. But there's a group in California that's been doing some very detailed toxicity studies this year with this specific dispersant. and they've been using them on these most sensitive life stages, so they have the best data, and their data show that it's about the one part per million level toxicity.
You mentioned the biodegradability of oil. There have also been studies done in Fort Valdez on low level accumulation of BETX from port operations there, which seem to imply that those substances will accumulate and then increase as you go up the food chain. What about those as a component of the oil that's being dispersed?
You're talking about a chronic discharge there. It's a little bit different. You have higher suspended sediments in Valdez Arm. And see, that's a pathway for the oil to be absorbed on the sediments in the water column under the bottom sediments, and therefore in that position it's not degraded as rapidly. When you have it mixing in the water column, you have a lot of oxygen and a lot of bacteria that actually enhance the degradation.
In the arm as opposed to in the port?
The open waters of Prince William Sound. You know, there's very low suspended sediments out there, so we don't expect to have a pathway by which the oil will get from the water column to the bottom sediments.
So you don't expect it to accumulate in the bottom sediments?
No, not a bit. Except, well, there will be certain conditions. If we get shoreline stranding, the oil can be absorbed on the sediments in the intertidal zone, and there you can have erosion from shoreline oil. And that's why it's very important, and I think Exxon is moving toward whenever there's any oil on the shoreline, they'll try to remove that through manual cleanup to prevent this leaching, particularly in areas where we have the herring spawning. Line of defense in any kind of oil spill is always removal, containment, and recovery. That's in every contingency plan. That's the highest priority and the highest preference. Dispersion is only a tool in the response kit that people use.
Specifically for the containment plan in this area, or you're speaking in general?
That's every contingency plan I've ever seen relies upon containment and recovery first. Case they want to recover the product. Dispersion is just an alternative to try to reduce these intertidal impacts. You know, the oil when it floats on the surface.
Governor, what is the latest information that you have regarding the stability of the Exxon Valdez?
Well, we think that the oil can be discharged now. It has to be done slowly. But it can be discharged without breaking up the vessel, which is what we've been afraid of ever since it went on the reef. However, the status of the ship seems to change daily, and the point at the moment is to be sure that we get that oil discharged into the Exxon Baton Rouge without disturbing its balance. It's precariously balanced on the reef. We don't want to have it roll over to one side and capsize, and we also don't want it to break in half, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that there were some problems when they were trying to offload on Sunday, there was some instability of the vessel and also some concern about it coming off the reef.
Yes, there was. In all these vessels, there's usually a computer system through which you can tell where you should offload without unbalancing the ship. Unfortunately, the computer system was out of whack after it hit the reef, which I suppose is understandable, but the computerized model had to be made out of Houston, so it was a little testy. It's still a little testy with that vessel, and we think that Exxon has the right formula now. That is, they can tell how to take the oil off the vessel without causing a serious imbalance.
You have declared this an emergency disaster area.
I sure have. It is a disaster.
What does that do? Does that free up immediately some state funds?
Well, it does in case we need it. It's also a signal. It's more of a statement than it is an important thing from a functional standpoint. We're also going to ask for a declaration of a federal emergency. As it turns out, I'm going to be speaking with President Bush on Saturday in any event. in Washington, and I certainly am going to bring up this subject. As a practical matter, the declaration of state and federal disasters probably won't mean that anything is done differently. It may mean that there is a different configuration in terms of who pays immediately. I say immediately because it's clear that Exxon is going to have to foot the bill sooner or later.
The latest estimate by the Coast Guard I heard is that the oil spill is 10 by 10, 100 square miles. Is that your information?
That's pretty close. It is. When I looked at it last, it was only, and I put that in quotes, about 32 square miles. And, of course, it continues to spread with time. So 100 square miles is about right.
What is your latest information from Commissioner Kelso? Has much of it or any of it reached shore?
At the moment, no, because we've been blessed with calm water there. It's a mixed blessing, however, because when you have calm water, you cannot use dispersants effectively. Dispersants are the chemicals that are dropped on the oil. The effect of the chemical is to break up the oil into much smaller pieces and then drop the oil to the ocean floor. The downside to the use of dispersants is that they are highly toxic to marine life, and so they need to be used in a very selective way. At the moment, what we need to do, number one, is to make sure that more oil isn't spilled. There was, the last time I talked to Valdez, about 900,000 barrels still on board the Exxon Valdez. Secondly, we have to utilize mechanical means to pick up as much oil as we possibly can while we still have the calm weather. And by the way, that may have changed during the night. And then third, we have to be very careful to try to clean up some of the selected areas that are most sensitive in terms of the wildlife as well as the fish runs. We can't get it all now, but we'd like to boom off those areas that are sensitive for reasons of the herring run or where we know there are large concentrations of salmon fry and salmon smolt. So we're going to try to do that. The effort will be limited because we simply don't have the equipment to clean up all 100 square miles. We just don't have it.
I understand also that some DEC officials and some local fishermen are planning to get out in boats at first light this morning, lay down some booms along sensitive areas. What is Exxon doing at this time?
Well, I can't speak for Exxon. I authorized Denny Kelso, the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, simply to take whatever steps he thought were necessary to clean it up. We thought the original response by Alyeska was slow and that it was inadequate. And Exxon has a right, really, to take charge of this cleanup. But frankly, we thought that action was pretty slow, and we have a state responsibility as well, which we've assumed. We need to work together with Exxon. We don't want two or three different operations going on which are uncoordinated. So it's enormously important that we're able to work together. Now, I assume that we will be able to do this with Exxon. Exxon and Denny Kelso had a number of meetings last night, which I understand resulted in an agreement for a coordinated effort. But frankly, I want every piece of equipment mobilized here. I don't want to see any equipment sitting in port and people arguing about whose responsibility it is or who's going to pay for it. We can sort that out later. This will be a lawyer's paradise for another 10 or 15 years. In the meantime, we want every available piece of equipment out there cleaning up this spill.
What is your understanding of marine life that has been affected already?
Well, It's been reported to me that there are some ducks and other marine birds that are in the oil. Some few have been picked up by the Coast Guard. And I was told that there were killer whales in the oil as well. I only got the one report of that. There are some sea otters in there. It's unlikely that any of those animals will survive. But at the moment, if you had to have this kind of spill, and of course we didn't, but since it happened, it's probably better that it happened now than at certain other times of the year. Although, if we have to use dispersants in a big way, it's going to hurt the small salmon, the juvenile salmon that are in Prince William Sound. There's no question about it. So there's no way of getting out of this without major damage to the wildlife and to the marine ecosystem. You can't get out of it without some damage. What we have to do now is to minimize it and to try to keep the toxicity levels when we use dispersants to a bare minimum. We have to be very selective about that.
An absorbent material that's called oil snare, mm-hmm. I think, is coming up from the lower 48, and that might be dropped on it and mm-hmm. would separate the thick crude into patches, and then that could be burned. Is that?
We hope that'll work, yeah, because the light oil will evaporate over time. The heavy crude, you have to get it either to the bottom or you have to collect it by mechanical means. We hope that will work. We want to mobilize every kind of methodology that we can to do the necessary here. It will probably require several different ways of collecting the oil. We want to use everything that we can, and we want to do it intelligently and coordinate the effort. Otherwise, the damage will be more extensive than it needs to be.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think I'll be a little more philosophical later on about what this means to Alaska. It's certainly not going to help the ANWR effort. That's for certain. At the moment, however, my attention is pretty much on cleaning up the oil spill and what we have to do to coordinate this effort and to bring every single asset we have to bear on this oil spill.
Mr. Cohen, can you tell us as of Wednesday afternoon what the status was on protecting those fish hatcheries in Prince William Sound?
There are four hatcheries on the west side of Prince William Sound. The state is in charge of the Main Bay hatchery, which is located to the west of Naked Island. The state has been in the process today of booming the area off of the bay to prevent oil from coming in to the net pen area. There are presently 600,000 sockeye smolt in net pens, and we're trying to keep the oil from getting to those net pens and basically destroying those fish.
That all told, the hatcheries in Prince William Sound produce, 30 to 35 million pink salmon a year?
I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. We're expecting a return of pink salmon this summer, both natural and hatchery fish, of approximately 41 million pink salmon. So you can see that that's just pink salmon alone. The Main Bay hatchery is a sockeye facility, and in fact is the largest sockeye producing hatchery in the world, I understand.
It's my understanding also that one of the hatcheries as of late Wednesday was not secured, one of the hatchery areas. Is that correct?
Right. That hatchery is under the authority of the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association, and they have been having, as I understand it, trouble in getting booms over there to block off the hatchery area from the oil. That is a pink salmon hatchery. As I understand it, the corporation has been trying today to get booming in place there. The next one up further north is the Main Bay hatchery. That's a state facility, and booming is in place there. There was a problem at one point today where the booming broke, but we have now, I understand, been able to fix that. and we're hoping that that will work. At this time, the wind is continuing in a direction which is not bringing oil into contact with the booming. The two other hatcheries are further north. That's Esther and Cannery Creek, and we're at a wait-and-see at this point on those two hatcheries. Our view is that if the fish, these young fish, are at a very sensitive life stage, and if they come into contact with oil or eat plankton that are contaminated with oil, that it will likely that there will be immediate killing of fish and then a chronic problem, which will mean that the fish will probably not be able to survive through adulthood. So those are the two things that we see happening to the salmon. In addition, there are 900 anadromous fish streams in Prince William Sound. At this point, the oil does not cover the beaches or the bays or the estuary in front of that many of these streams, but if it does go onshore to the west side of Prince William Sound, it will hit a lot of them, including some pretty important ones. So there is a lot of impact that may still be happening here, which we have not seen.
How about other marine life in the Sound?
I was going to, I'll be happy to talk about that. The first one is herring. The herring fishery, we anticipate the resource, the biomass into Prince William Sound this year at 110 million pounds. That means that the fishery would be able to harvest approximately 14 to 16 million pounds. Two of the spawning areas, we have split up Prince William Sound into four areas for purposes of our analysis. Two of these spawning areas, Naked Island and Montague, have been oiled. So we're concerned about what would happen if the herring actually spawned in these areas or if they were displaced from the areas and tried to spawn somewhere else, whether there would be any survival. So that will go into, so we're very concerned about the herring eggs, and the fishery that may be conducted, and we'll be making decisions on the fisheries as pretty soon, as early as this weekend, on some of the fisheries as it goes through the spawning period.
Isn't there a longline black cod fishery scheduled to open in the next couple of days?
There were two fisheries that we have closed. We closed the pot shrimp fishery, and that it will be closed effective April 3rd. It has been going on since March 15th. There was also to be a black cod, which is also a sablefish fishery, that was to open on April 1st, and that has now been closed. Mainly our concern is oiling of equipment and potentially oiling of the fish as they are pulled through the water column.
How does it look for the herring fishery?
It's really iffy at this point. We're not sure.
Okay. The condition, though, of other marine mammals in Prince William Sound, we've heard reports that some killer whales have been sighted in the oil slick, also that there are several substantial sea otter colonies in Prince William Sound. Can you give us an update on that?
I can. The marine mammals that we see as having the most likely impact are sea otters and sea lions. There are have been reported hundreds of sea otters oiled at this time, and that virtually means death for those sea otters. Sea lion rookeries are important, haul out areas. Some of them have been affected. Some of the major ones have not yet been, and we're still waiting to see what's going to happen with the sea otters, with the sea lions, excuse me. In addition, we're going to be seeing in the next couple of weeks and actually even maybe sooner than that, California gray whales and humpback whales coming into the area. There's groups of them which normally feed in Prince William Sound, and some of the area in which they feed is a night passage which has been oiled.
Exxon's President Bill Stevens made very clear to us yesterday that they are prepared to bear the full burden of expense related to the cleanup, to the direct impacts and the third-party costs. I made a suggestion to them that they consider dealing also with some of the non-commercial impacts that have to do with the wildlife destruction. They expressed interest in that, and I think that As of the moment, we are encouraged that they're acting as responsibly as could be expected in the wake of a very serious problem.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Commandant Yost, can I have one question, please? There have been reports that perhaps the Coast Guard didn't respond adequately, that a radar installation should have warned off this ship from that area, and in fact, in the subsequent investigation, didn't act in a timely fashion to test the crew for any presence of alcohol. Have you had a chance to assess the Coast Guard's performance in this incident?
I had it.
Would you answer from the mic, sir?
Thank you.
We were up there for about 2 days. That's not a long time to assess. We will investigate it much more thoroughly. The Coast Guard responded very, very quickly. Our response gear is located in San Francisco. We loaded two or three C-130 airplane loads of equipment, pumps, boom, et cetera, and sent it immediately up there with experts from our strike team. Those experts were key in the offloading of that tanker. They have it about one-third offloaded, going towards a half. Our response was superb. I will look at the response of the Valdez Vessel Traffic Service itself. But that's a very wide roadstead. Remember, we've got 10 miles of open water there, and that vessel to have come over and hit a reef is almost unbelievable. It's not something that the vessel traffic system was designed to keep vessels from doing. We would need vessel traffic systems up and down the coasts of the United States if we're going to try to keep every vessel from hitting the beach. You can't do that. This was not a treacherous area, as you people in the press have called it. It is not treacherous in the area they went aground. It's 10 miles wide. Your children could drive a tanker up through it.
Let me just say one thing. The one assessment you get up there, having spent that time, is everybody is working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sometimes with 3 and 4 hours worth of sleep, including the Coast Guard, state officials, federal officials, contract people under Exxon's direction, Exxon employees, to deal with this problem. So right now, everybody is working as hard as they can to do it, and I think we ought to recognize that. It is a difficult problem. All maximum effort will be put forth. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to live coverage of a White House press conference with Secretary of Transportation Samuel Skinner and other Bush administration officials who have just returned from Valdez and the Exxon oil spill.
Last night, a week after the wreck of the good ship Exxon Valdez, having successfully navigated the early stages of mourning, anger, denial, guilt, I realized I had entered the final stage when sorrow turns to prayer. So I got out my Prince William Sound journal, and I searched through it for memories of the wild creatures I'd seen there. August 20th, 1986. This morning we took the skiff up a tide channel into an inner salt lagoon with a salmon stream at its head. As we pushed slowly up the channel, a harbor seal streaked by underwater, not rising to look back at us until it was almost around the first bend. The stream was about 30 feet wide and almost solid with salmon, no more than a few inches between any two of them all the way across. Farther up, the forest closed in around white sandbars and deep, purest emerald green pools teeming with fish. From high up on the bank, from deep devil's club and ferns and low, overhanging hemlock boughs, came the loud, snorting woof of a bear, then the sound of brush crashing and a glimpse of brown fur moving fast up the mountain. August 27th. Montague Island. Slow drizzle all day. Saw a Steller's Jay so wet its blue was soaked too dark to see. Many bedraggled eagles lurking on snags over the water. A fox sparrow, kingfishers, and a sharp-shinned hawk. All day the eerie squawks and whistles and whirrings of thousands of seabirds, mostly murres and murrelets, floated through the mist across still water dappled by rain. August 29th. Night Island. Killer whales. 42 animals spread out over a half square mile, two pods traveling together. An extended family? A tribe? I learned last night that each pod in Prince William Sound speaks its own dialect of the killer whale language. September 4th. early evening in a small cove near Simpson Bay. Golden light glows through the feathers of a gull gliding by close overhead. Salmon leap, fall back with soft smacks on the water, crystal clear water, deepest blue. A cone-shaped avenue of light expands out across the water, flows sparkling toward snow-capped mountains and the setting sun. Floating, asleep on her back, her pup held tightly in her arms, a mother sea otter drifts gently towards us on an incoming tide. September 9th. This morning, from a small rocky island across from Columbia Glacier, we watched an oil tanker slide out of Valdez Narrows. It was one of those scenes Alaskans take pride in, straight-lined, gleaming, metal, confident 20th-century technology moving through a magnificent Alaska landscape, a fine scene to show anyone who doubts that oil development can happen here. We can drill for oil at the mouth of Bristol Bay. We can explore for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Watching the tanker move so purposefully, so dutifully out to sea, for a brief moment I believed. I'll admit it, I bought the party line. It can't happen here, not in this perfect place. It was the Watergate hearings and the horrifying fireworks of the Space Shuttle Challenger combined. With each witness, over and over, we boarded the huge dark tanker in Valdez, cast off, and pushed through the night toward our midnight rendezvous with the red flashing light on Bligh Reef. In painfully slow-motion replay, we followed each version of the story to its inevitable conclusion and then returned to pick up the next one. We were TV soap opera addicts as we studied their twitching faces and halting speech, their restless hands pouring glass after glass of ice water. Who were they? What went wrong? How? Tell us. We have to know. It was all just words, dry, emotionless words, spoken on demand by frightened men. But still, we were able to fill in light and shadow, smells and sounds. At times, it seemed we were some primitive tribe crouched around the cool fire of our TVs, hearing stories about how the world began. And something did begin that night, something big, much bigger even than the millions of lives snuffed out by the oil. Despite the best efforts of the oil industry and our oil-fed politicians to assure us that steps will be taken, despite their best attempts to lull us with the completely irrelevant fact that no human lives were lost, to reassure us with the utterly ignorant promise that Mother Nature will clean up after us the way she always does, some new power was born in the blackness that gushed from the wreck of the Exxon Valdez that night. The chief mate, James Kunkel, the only first-hand witness to show any emotion, spoke for many of us as he described the awful moment when the ship ran aground. "I don't mind telling you," he said. "I knew that my world would never be the same again." A recent national survey found that almost 2 months after the accident, 52% of the Americans polled were still intently following news of the spill. So it's tempting to suppose the catastrophe in Prince William Sound has given symbolic focus to deeper fears, the kind of anxieties stirred up by last summer's droughts and unprecedented high temperatures, the long-term effects of acid rain, the depletion of the ozone layer, and many other problems. Could it be that Exxon, however unwittingly, has triggered a period in American history when the word environmentalist will become obsolete? And none too soon. Those most closely watching the environmental effects of mankind's abuse of this planet agree that the decade of the 90s will either make or break us. As Lester Brown and his colleagues have written in the 1989 edition of the World Watch Institute's State of the World report, the outlines of this new age will be defined by choices made in the years immediately ahead. We will either mobilize to reestablish a stable relationship with the Earth's natural support systems or continue down the path of environmental deterioration. We're now turning Spaceship Earth into the incoming vessel traffic lane and have begun to skirt the edge of the ice. At least while Reagan's pale shadow remains in the White House, the captain will be gone from the bridge. Not far ahead, a red light flashes over the year 2000. It's you and me at the helm, and third mate Gregory Cousins and helmsman Robert Kagan, too, back for one more try. "I called the captain," Cousins told us last week. "I called the captain, and I told him, I think we're in serious trouble."